trust and reliance that were already there, so that the reality of her feelings stole gradually upon her, as they had upon him.
"You haven't got a drink, Gaff," said Miles. "That situation must be remedied."
He led his partner firmly to the drinks table and poured him a beer, talking all the while, and like Howard, giving off an almost visible glow of happiness and pride.
"You heard I won the seat?"
Gavin had not, but he did not feel equal to feigning surprise.
"Yeah, congratulations. How's Mary?" asked Miles, expansively.
He was a friend to the whole town tonight, because it has elected him.
"She doing okay?"
"Yeah, I think."
"I heard she might be going to Liverpool. Might be for the best."
"What?" said Gavin sharply.
"Maureen was saying this morning, apparently Mary's sister's trying to persuade Mary to go home with the kids. She's still got a lot of family in Liverpool."
"This is her home."
"I think it was Barry who liked Pagford. I'm not sure Mary will want to stay without him."
Gaia was watching Gavin through a chink in the kitchen door. She was clutching a paper cup containing several fingers of the vodka that Andrew had stolen for her.
"He's such a bastard," she said. "We'd still be in Hackney if he hadn't led Mum on. She's so bloody stupid. I could have told her he wasn't that interested. He never took her out. He couldn't wait to leave after they'd shagged."
Andrew, who was piling additional sandwiches on an almost empty platter behind her, could hardly believe that she was using words like shagged. The chimeric Gaia who filled his fantasies was a sexually inventive and adventurous virgin. He did not know what the real Gaia had done, or not done, with Marco De Luca. Her judgment on her mother made it sound as if she knew how men behaved after sex, if they were interested.
"Drink something," she told Andrew, as he approached the door with the platter, and she held up her own polystyrene cup to his lips, and he drank some of her vodka. Giggling a little, she backed away to let him out and called after him, "Make Sooks come in here and get some."
The hall was crowded and noisy. Andrew put the pile of fresh sandwiches on the table, but interest in the food seemed to have waned. Sukhvinder was struggling to keep up with demand at the drinks table, and many people had started pouring their own.
"Gaia wants you in the kitchen," Andrew told Sukhvinder, and he took over for her. There was no point acting like a bartender. Instead, he filled as many glasses as he could find and left them on the table for people to help themselves.
"Hi, Peanut," said Lexi Mollison. "Can I have some champagne?"
They had been at St. Thomas's together, but he'd not seen her for a long time. Her accent had changed since she'd been at St. Anne's. He hated being called Peanut. "It's there in front of you," he said, pointing.
"Lexi, you are not drinking," snapped Samantha, appearing out of the crowd. "Absolutely not. Grandad said, I don't care. Everyone else, I said no."
Lexi stomped away. Andrew, glad to see her go, smiled at Samantha and was surprised when she beamed at him.
"Do you talk back to your parents?"
"Yeah," he said, and she laughed. Her breasts really were enormous. "Ladies and gentlemen," boomed a voice through the microphone, and everybody stopped talking to listen to Howard. "Wanted to say a few words. Most of you probably know by now that my son Miles has just been elected to the parish council."
There was a smattering of applause, and Miles raised his drink high above his head to acknowledge it. Andrew was startled to hear Samantha say quite clearly under her breath, "Who fucking Ray?" Nobody was coming for drinks now. Andrew slipped back into the kitchen. Gaia and Sukhvinder were alone in there, drinking and laughing, and when they saw Andrew, they both shouted,
"Andy!"
He laughed too.
"Are you both pissed?"
"Yes,"
said Gaia, and "No," said Sukhvinder.
"She is, though."
"I don't care,"
said Gaia.
"Mollison can sack me if he wants. No point saving up for a ticket to Hackney anymore."
"He won't sack you," said Andrew, helping himself to some of the vodka. "You're his favourite."
"Yeah," said Gaia. "Creepy old bastard."
and the three of them laughed again. Through the glass doors, amplified by the microphone, came Maureen's croaky voice.
Come on then, Howard. Come on. A duet for your birthday. Go on, ladies and gentlemen. Howard's favourite song.
The teenagers gazed at each other in tantalised horror. Gaia tripped forward, giggling, and pushed the door open. The first few bars of the green, green grass of home blared out, and then, in Howard's bass and Maureen's gravelly alto, "The old hometown looks the same as I stepped down from the train." Gavin was the only one who heard the giggles and snorts, but when he turned around, all he saw were the double doors to the kitchen swinging a little on their hinges. Miles had left to chat with Aubrey and Julia Fawley, who had arrived late, wreathed in polite smiles. Gavin was in the grip of a familiar mixture of dread and anxiety. His brief, sunlit haze of freedom and happiness had been overcast by the twin threats of Gaia blabbing what he'd said to her mother and of Mary leaving Pagford forever. What was he going to do?
"Down the lane I walk with my sweet Mary, hair of gold and lips like cherries."
"Kay not here?" Samantha had arrived, leaning against the table beside him, smirking.
"You already asked me that," said Gavin.
"No."
"Everything okay with you two?"
"Is it really any of your business?" It slipped out of him before he could stop it. He was sick of her constant probing and jeering. For once, it was just the two of them. Miles was still busy with the Fawleys. She overacted being taken aback. Her eyes were bloodshot and her speech was deliberate. For the first time, Gavin felt more dislike than intimidation.
"I'm sorry. I was only asking."
"Yeah," he said, as Howard and Maureen swayed arm in arm.
"I'd like to see you settled down. You and Kay seemed good together."
"Yeah, well, I like my freedom," said Gavin. "I don't know many happily married couples." Samantha had drunk too much to feel the full force of the dig, but she had the impression that one had been made.
"Marriages are always a mystery to outsiders," she said carefully. "Nobody can ever really know except the two people involved, so you shouldn't judge, Gavin."
"Thanks for the insight," he said, and, irritated past endurance, he set down his empty beer can and headed towards the cloakroom. Samantha watched him leave, sure that she had had the best of the encounter, and turned her attention to her mother-in-law, whom she could see through a gap in the crowd, watching Howard and Maureen sing. Samantha relished Shirley's anger, which was expressed in the tightest, coldest smile she had worn all evening. Howard and Maureen had performed together many a time over the years. Howard loved to sing, and Maureen had once performed backing vocals for a local skiffle band. When the song finished, Shirley clapped her hands together once. She might have been summoning a flunky. And Samantha laughed out loud and moved along to the bar end of the table, which she was disappointed to find unmanned by the boy in the bow tie. Andrew, Gaia and Sukhvinder were still convulsed in the kitchen. They laughed because of Howard and Maureen's duet, and because they had finished two-thirds of the vodka, but mostly they laughed because they laughed, feeding off each other until they could barely stand. The little window over the sink, propped ajar so that the kitchen did not become too steamy, rattled and clattered, and Fats's head appeared through it. "Evening," he said. Evidently he had climbed onto something outside, because with a noise of scraping and a heavy object falling over, more and more of him emerged through the window until he landed heavily onto the draining board, knocking several glasses to the ground, where they shattered. Sukhvinder walked straight out of the kitchen. Andrew knew immediately that he did not want Fats there. Only Gaia seemed unperturbed. Still giggling, she said, "There's a door, you know."
"No shit," said Fats. "Where's the drink?"
"This is ours," said Gaia, cradling the vodka in her arms. Andy nicked it. You'll have to get your own.
Not a problem, said Fats coolly, and he walked through the doors into the hall.
Need the loo, mumbled Gaia, and she stowed the vodka bottle back under the sink and left the kitchen too. Andrew followed. Sukhvinder had returned to the bar area. Gaia was disappearing into the bathroom, and Fats was leaning against the trestle table with a beer in one hand and a sandwich in the other.
Didn't think you'd want to come to this, said Andrew.
I was invited, mate, said Fats. It was on the invitation. Whole wall family.
Does Cubby know you're here?
Dunno, said Fats. He's in hiding. Didn't get old Barry's seat after all. The whole social fabric will collapse now Cubby's not holding it together.
Fucking hell, that's horrible, he added, spitting out a mouthful of sandwich.
Want a fag?
The hall was so noisy and the guests so raucously drunk that nobody seemed to care where Andrew went anymore. When they got outside, they found Patricia Mollison, alone beside her sports car, looking up at the clear, starry sky, smoking.
You can have one of these, she said, offering her packet, if you want.
After she had lit their cigarettes, she stood at her ease with one hand balled deep in her pocket. There was something about her that Andrew found intimidating. He could not even bring himself to glance at Fats to gauge his reaction.
I'm Pat, she told them after a little while. Howard and Shirley's daughter.
Hi, said Andrew. Mandrew.
Stuart, said Fats. She did not seem to need to prolong conversation. Andrew felt it as a kind of compliment and tried to emulate her indifference. The silence was broken by footsteps and the sound of muffled girls' voices. Gaia was dragging Sukhvinder outside by the hand. She was laughing, and Andrew could tell that the full effect of the vodka was still intensifying inside her.
You, said Gaia to Fats, are really horrible to Sukhvinder.
Stop it, said Sukhvinder, tugging against Gaia's hand.
I'm serious, let me... He is, said Gaia breathlessly. You are. Do you put stuff on her Facebook?
Stop it, shouted Sukhvinder.
She wrenched herself free and plunged back inside the party.
You are horrible to her, said Gaia,
grabbing onto the railings for support,
calling her a lesbian and stuff.
Nothing wrong with being a lesbian, said Patricia. Her eyes narrowed through the smoke she was inhaling. But then I would say that.
Andrew saw Fats look at Pat sideways. I never said there was anything wrong with it. It's only jokes, he said.
Gaia slid down the rails to sit on the chilly pavement, her head in her arms.
You all right? Andrew asked. If Fats had not been there, he would have sat down too.
Pissed, she muttered.
Might do better to stick your fingers down your throat, suggested Patricia, looking down at her dispassionately.
Nice car,
Fats said, eyeing the BMW.
Yeah, said Patricia. New.
I make double what my brother makes, she said. But Miles is the Christ child. Miles the Messiah. Parish Councillor Mollison the Second of Pagford.
Do you like Pagford?
She asked Fats, while Andrew watched Gaia breathing deeply, her head between her knees.
No, said Fats. It's a shithole.
Yeah, well, I couldn't wait to leave, personally.
Did you know Barry Fairbrother?
A bit, said Fats.
Something in his voice made Andrew worried.
He was my reading mentor, said Patricia, with her eyes still on the end of the street.
Lovely bloke.
I would have come back for the funeral, but Melly and I were in Zermatt.
What's all this stuff my mother's been gloating about? This Barry's ghost stuff.
Someone putting stuff on the parish website? Said Andrew hastily, afraid of what Fats might say if he let him.
Rumours and stuff.
Yeah, my mother would love that, said Patricia.
Wonder what the ghost'll say next? Fats asked, with a sidelong glance at Andrew.
Probably stop now the election's over, muttered Andrew.
Oh, I don't know, said Fats.
if there's stuff old Barry's ghost is still pissed off about. He knew that he was making Andrew anxious, and he was glad of it. Andrew was spending all his time at his poxy job these days, and he would soon be moving. Fats did not owe Andrew anything. True authenticity could not exist alongside guilt and obligation. "You all right down there?" Patricia asked Gaia, who nodded, with her face still hidden. "What was it, the drink or the duet that made you feel sick?" Andrew laughed a little bit, out of politeness and because he wanted to keep the subject away from the ghost of Barry Fairbrother. "Turned my stomach too," said Patricia. "Old Maureen and my father singing along together, arm in arm." Patricia took a final fierce drag on her cigarette and threw the end down, grinding it beneath her heel. "I walked in on her blowing him when I was 12, she said, "and he gave me a fiver not to tell my mother." Andrew and Fats stood transfixed, scared even to look at each other. Patricia wiped her face on the back of her hand. She was crying. "Shouldn't have bloody come," she said. "Knew I shouldn't." She got into the BMW, and the two boys watched, stunned, as she turned on the engine, reversed out of her parking space, and drove away into the night. "Fuck me," said Fats. "Think I might be sick," whispered Gaia. "Mr. Morrison wants you back inside for the drinks." A message delivered, Sukhvinder darted away again. "I can't," whispered Gaia. Andrew left her there. The din in the hall hit him as he opened the inner doors. The disco was in full swing. He had to move aside to allow Aubrey and Julia Fawley room to leave. Both, with their backs to the party, looked grimly pleased to be going. Samantha Mollison was not dancing, but was leaning up against the trestle table where so recently there had been rows and rows of drinks. While Sukhvinder rushed around collecting glasses, Andrew unpacked the last box of clean ones, set them out and filled them. "Your bow tie's crooked," Samantha told him, and she leaned across the table and straightened it for him. Embarrassed, he ducked into the kitchen as soon as she let go. Between each load of glasses he put in the dishwasher, Andrew took another swig of the vodka he'd stolen. He wanted to be drunk like Gaia. He wanted to return to that moment when they had been laughing uncontrollably together, before Fats had appeared. After 10 minutes, he checked the drinks table again. Samantha was still propped up against it, glassy-eyed, and there were plenty of fresh-poured drinks left for her to enjoy. Howard was bobbing in the middle of the dance floor, sweat pouring down his face, roaring with laughter at something Maureen had said to him. Andrew wound his way through the crowd and back outside. He could not see where she was at first. Then he spotted them. Gaia and Fats were locked together 10 yards away from the door, leaning up against the railings, bodies pressed tight against each other, tongues working in each other's mouths.
"Look, I'm sorry, but I can't do it all," said Sukhvinder desperately from behind him.
Then she spotted Fats and Gaia and let out something between a yelp and a sob. Andrew walked back into the hall with her, completely numb. In the kitchen, he poured the remainder of the vodka into a glass and downed it in one. Mechanically, he filled the sink and set to washing out the glasses that could not fit in the dishwasher. The alcohol was not like dope. It made him feel empty, but also keen to hit someone. Fats, for instance. After a while, he realized that the plastic clock on the kitchen wall had leapt from midnight to one and that people were leaving. He was supposed to find Coates. He tried for a while, but then lurched off to the kitchen again, leaving Sukhvinder in charge. Samantha was leaning up against the fridge, on her own, with a glass in her hand. Andrew's vision was strangely jerky, like a series of stills. Gaia had not come back. She was doubtless long gone with Fats. Samantha was talking to him. She was drunk too, He was not embarrassed by her any more. He suspected that he might be sick quite soon.
"Hate bloody Pagford," said Samantha, "and,
but you're young enough to get out."
"Yeah," he said, unable to feel his lips, "and I will, and I will."
She pushed his hair off his forehead and called him sweet. The image of Gaia with her tongue in Fats's mouth threatened to obliterate everything. He could smell Samantha's perfume coming in waves from her hot skin.
"That band's shit," he said, pointing at her chest, but he did not think she heard him.
Her mouth was chapped and warm, and her breasts were huge, pressed against his chest. Her back was as broad as his.
"What the fuck?"
Andrew was slumped against the draining board, and Samantha was being dragged out of the kitchen by a big man with short greying hair. Andrew had a dim idea that something bad had happened, but the strange flickering quality of reality was becoming more and more pronounced, until the only thing to do was to stagger across the room to the bin and throw up again and again and again.
"Sorry, you can't come in," he heard Sukhvinder tell someone. "Stuff piled up against the door."
He tied the bin bag tightly on his own vomit. Sukhvinder helped him clear the kitchen. He needed to throw up twice more, but both times managed to get to the bathroom. It was nearly 2 o'clock by the time Howard, sweaty but smiling, thanked them and said good night.
"Very good work," he said. "See you tomorrow, then. Very good. Where's Miss Borden, by the way?"
Andrew left Sukhvinder to come up with a lie. Out in the street, he unchained Simon's bicycle and wheeled it away into the darkness. The long, cold walk back to Hilltop House cleared his head, but assuaged neither his bitterness nor his misery. Had he ever told Fats that he fancied Gaia? Maybe not. But Fats knew. He knew that Fats knew. Were they, perhaps, shagging right now? "I'm moving anyway," Andrew thought, bent over and shivering as he pushed the bicycle up the hill. "So fuck them." And then he thought, "I'd better be moving." Had he just snogged Lexi Mollison's mother? Had her husband walked in on them? Had that really happened? He was scared of Miles, but he also wanted to tell Fats about it, to see his face. When he let himself into the house, exhausted, Simon's voice came out of the darkness from the kitchen. "Have you put my bike in the garage?" He was sitting at the kitchen table, eating a bowl of cereal. It was nearly 2:30 in the morning. "Couldn't sleep," said Simon. For once, he was not angry. Ruth was not there, so he did not have to prove himself bigger or smarter than his sons. He seemed weary and small. "Think we're going to have to move to Reading, Pizza Face," said Simon. It was almost a term of endearment. Shivering slightly, feeling old and shell-shocked and immensely guilty, Andrew wanted to give his father something to make up for what he'd done. It was time to redress balances and claim Simon as an ally. They were a family. They had to move together. Perhaps it could be better, somewhere else.
"I've got something for you," he said. "Come through here. Found out how to do it at school."
And he led the way to the computer.
4. A misty blue sky stretched like a dome over Pagford and the fields. Dawn light shone upon the old stone war memorial in the square, on the cracked concrete facades of Foley Road, and turned the white walls of Hilltop House pale gold. As Ruth Price climbed into her car ready for another long shift at the hospital, she looked down at the River Aure, shining like a silver ribbon in the distance,
and felt how completely unjust it was that somebody else would soon have her house and her view. A mile below, in Church Row, Samantha Mollison was still sound asleep in the spare bedroom. There was no lock on the door, but she had barricaded it with an armchair before collapsing, semi-dressed, onto the bed. The beginnings of a vicious headache disturbed her slumber, and the sliver of sunshine that had penetrated the gap in the curtains fell like a laser beam across the corner of one eye. She twitched a little, in the depths of her dry-mouthed, anxious half-sleep, and her dreams were guilty and strange. Downstairs, among the clean, bright surfaces of the kitchen, Miles sat bolt upright and alone, with an untouched mug of tea in front of him, staring at the fridge, and stumbling again in his mind's eye upon his drunken wife locked in the embrace of a 16-year-old schoolboy. Three houses away, Fats Wall lay smoking in his bedroom in the clothes he had worn to Howard Mollison's birthday party. He had wanted to stay awake all night, and he had done it. His mouth was slightly numb and tingly from all the cigarettes he had smoked, but his tiredness had had the reverse effect of the one that he had hoped. He was unable to think very clearly, but his unhappiness and unease were as acute as ever. Colin Wall woke, drenched in sweat, from another night of the nightmares that had tormented him for years. He had always done terrible things in the dreams, the kinds of things that he spent his waking life dreading, and this time he had killed Barry Fairbrother, and the authorities had only just found out, and had come to tell him that they knew, that they had dug up Barry and found the poison that Colin had administered. Staring up at the lampshade's familiar shadow on the ceiling, Colin wondered why he had never considered the possibility that he had killed Barry, and at once the question presented itself to him. How do you know you didn't? Downstairs, Tessa was injecting insulin into her stomach. She knew that Fats had come home the previous evening because she could smell the cigarette smoke at the bottom of the stairs to his attic bedroom. Where he had been and what time he had come in, she did not know, and it frightened her. How had things come to this? Howard Mollison was sleeping soundly and happily in his double bed. The patterned curtains dappled him with pink petals and protected him from a crude awakening, but his rattling, wheezing snores had roused his wife. Shirley was eating toast and drinking coffee in the kitchen, wearing her glasses and her candlewick dressing gown. She visualized Maureen swaying arm in arm with her husband in the village hall, and experienced a concentrated loathing that took the taste from every mouthful. In the smithy, a few miles outside Pagford, Gavin Hughes soaped himself under a hot shower and wondered why he had never had the courage of other men, and how they managed to make the right choices among almost infinite alternatives. There was a yearning inside him for a life he had glimpsed but never tasted, yet he was afraid. Choice was dangerous. You had to forgo all other possibilities when you chose. Kay Borden was lying awake and exhausted in bed in Hope Street, listening to the early morning quiet of Pagford and watching Gaia, who was asleep beside her in the double bed, pale and drained in the early daylight. There was a bucket next to Gaia on the floor, placed there by Kay, who had half carried her daughter from bathroom to bedroom in the early hours, after holding her hair out of the toilet for an hour. "Why did you make us come here?" Gaia had wailed, as she choked and retched over the bowl. "Get off me, get off, I hate you." Kay watched the sleeping face and recalled the beautiful little baby who had slept beside her 16 years ago. She remembered the tears that Gaia had shed when Kay had split up with Steve, her live-in partner of 8 years. Steve had attended Gaia's parents' evenings and taught her to ride a bicycle. Kay remembered the fantasy she had nurtured, with hindsight as silly as 4-year-old Gaia's wish for a unicorn, that she would settle down with Gavin and give Gaia, at last, a permanent stepfather and a beautiful house in the country. how desperate she had been for a storybook ending and a life to which Gaia would always want to return, because her daughter's departure was hurtling towards Kay like a meteorite, and she foresaw the loss of Gaia as a calamity that would shatter her world. Kay reached out a hand beneath the duvet and held Gaia's. The feel of the warm flesh that she had accidentally brought into the world made Kay start to weep, quietly, but so violently that the mattress shook. And at the bottom of Church Row, Parminder Jawanda slipped a coat on over her nightdress and took her coffee into the back garden. Sitting in the chilly sunlight on a wooden bench, she saw that it was promising to be a beautiful day, but there seemed to be a blockage between her eyes and her heart. The heavy weight on her chest deadened everything. The news that Miles Mollison had won Barry's seat on the parish council had not been a surprise, but on seeing Shirley's neat little announcement on the website, she had known another flicker of that madness that had overtaken her at the last meeting, a desire to attack, superseded almost at once by stifling hopelessness. "I'm going to resign from the council," she told Vikram. "What's the point?" "But you like it," he had said. She had liked it when Barry had been there too. It was easy to conjure him up this morning when everything was quiet and still. A little ginger-bearded man. She had been taller than him by half a head. She had never felt the slightest physical attraction towards him. What was love after all? Thought Parminder, as a gentle breeze ruffled the tall hedge of Leyland cypresses that enclosed the Jawanda's big back lawn. Was it love when somebody filled a space in your life that yawned inside you once they had gone? "I did love laughing," thought Parminder. "I really miss laughing." And it was the memory of laughter that, at last, made the tears flow from her eyes. They trickled down her nose and into her coffee, where they made little bullet holes swiftly erased. She was crying because she never seemed to laugh anymore, and also because the previous evening, while they had been listening to the jubilant distant thump of the disco in the town hall, Vikram had said, "Why don't we visit Amritsar this summer?" The Golden Temple, the holiest shrine of the religion to which he was indifferent. She had known at once what Vikram was doing. Time lay slack and empty on her hands as never before in her life. Neither of them knew what the GMC would decide to do with her once it had considered her ethical breach towards Howard Mollison. "Mandeep says it's a big tourist trap," she had replied, dismissing Amritsar at a stroke. "Why did I say that?" Parminder wondered, crying harder than ever in the garden with her coffee cooling in her hand. "It'd be good to show the children Amritsar. He was trying to be kind. Why didn't I say yes?" She felt dimly that she had betrayed something in refusing the Golden Temple. A vision of it swam through her tears, its lotus flower dome reflected in a sheet of water, honey bright against a backdrop of white marble. "Mum?" Sukhvinder had crossed the lawn without Parminder noticing. She was dressed in jeans and a baggy sweatshirt. Parminder hastily wiped her face and squinted at Sukhvinder, who had her back to the sun. "I don't want to go to work today." Parminder responded at once, in the same spirit of automatic contradiction that had made her turn down Amritsar. "You made a commitment, Sukhvinder." "I don't feel well." "I mean, you're tired. You're the one who wanted this job. Now you fulfill your obligations." "But you're going to work," snapped Parminder. And she might have been pronouncing sentence. "You're not giving the Mollisons another reason to complain." After Sukhvinder walked back to the house, Parminder felt guilty. She almost called her daughter back, but instead she made a mental note that she must try and find time to sit down with her sometime and talk to her without arguing. 5. Crystal was walking along Foley Road in the early morning sunlight, eating a banana. It was an unfamiliar taste and texture, and she could not make up her mind whether she liked it or not. Terry and Crystal never bought fruit. Nikki's mother had just turfed her unceremoniously out of the house. "We got things to do, Crystal," she had said. "We're going to Nikki's grand's for dinner." As an afterthought, she had handed Crystal a banana to eat for breakfast. Crystal had left without protest. There was barely enough room for Nikki's family around the kitchen table. The fields were not improved by sunshine, which merely showed up the dirt and the damage, the cracks in the concrete walls, the boarded windows and the litter. The square in Pagford looked freshly painted whenever the sun shone. Twice a year, the primary school children had walked through the middle of town, crocodile fashion, on their way to church for Christmas and Easter services. Nobody had ever wanted to hold Crystal's hand. Fats had told them all she had fleas. She wondered whether he remembered. There had been hanging baskets full of flowers, splashes of purple, pink and green, and every time Crystal had passed one of the planted troughs outside the Black Cannon, she had pulled off a petal. Each one had been cool and slippery in her fingers, swiftly becoming slimy and brown as she clutched it, and she usually wiped it off on the underside of a warm wooden pew in St. Michael's. She let herself into her house, and saw at once, through the open door to her left, that Terry had not gone to bed. She was sitting in her armchair with her eyes closed and her mouth open. Crystal closed the door with a snap, but Terry did not stir. Crystal was at Terry's side in four strides, shaking her thin arm. Terry's head fell forwards onto her shrunken chest. She snored. Crystal let go of her. The vision of a dead man in the bathroom swam back into her subconscious. "Silly bitch," she said. Then it occurred to her that Robbie was not there. She pounded up the stairs, shouting for him.
"I'm here,"
she heard him say, from behind her own closed bedroom door. When she shouldered it open, she saw Robbie standing there, naked. Behind him, scratching his bare chest, lying on her own mattress, was Obbo. "All right, Chris," he said, grinning. She seized Robbie and pulled him into his own room. Her hands trembled so badly that it took her ages to dress him.
"Did he do something to you?"
she whispered to Robbie.
"I'm hungry," said Robbie.
When he was dressed, she picked him up and ran downstairs. She could hear Obbo moving around in her bedroom.
"Why is he here?"
she shouted at Terry, who was drowsily awake in her chair.
"Why is he with Robbie?"
Robbie fought to get out of her arms. He hated shouting.
"What the fuck's that?"
screamed Crystal, spotting for the first time two black holdalls lying beside Terry's armchair.
"It's nothing," said Terry vaguely.
But Crystal had already forced one of the zips open.
"It's nothing,"
shouted Terry. Big, brick-like blocks of hashish wrapped neatly in sheets of polythene. Crystal, who could barely read, who could not have identified half the vegetables in a supermarket, who could not have named the Prime Minister, knew that the contents of the bag, if discovered on the premises, meant prison for her mother. Then she saw the tin, with the coachman and horses on the lid, half protruding from the chair on which Terry was sitting.
"You've used," said Crystal breathlessly,
as disaster rained invisibly around her and everything collapsed.
"You've fucking..."
She heard Obbo on the stairs, and she snatched up Robbie again. He wailed and struggled in her arms, frightened by her anger, but Crystal's grip was unbreakable.
"Fucking let him go,"
called Terry, fruitlessly. Crystal had opened the front door and was running as fast as she could, encumbered by Robbie, who was resisting and moaning, back along the road. 6. Shirley showered and pulled clothes out of the wardrobe while Howard slept noisily on. The church bell of St. Michael and All Saints, ringing for 10 o'clock matins, reached her as she buttoned up her cardigan. She always thought how loud it must be for the Joanders, living right opposite, and hoped that it struck them as a loud proclamation of Pagford's adherence to the old ways and traditions of which they, so conspicuously, were not a part.
Automatically, because it was what she so often did, Shirley walked along the hall, turned into Patricia's old bedroom, and sat down at the computer. Patricia ought to be here, sleeping on the sofa bed that Shirley had made up for her. It was a relief not to have to deal with her this morning. Howard, who had still been humming "The Green, Green Grass of Home" when they arrived at Ambleside in the early hours, had not realized that Patricia was absent until Shirley had had the key in the front door.
"Where's Pat?"
he had wheezed, leaning against the porch.
"Oh, she was upset that Melly didn't want to come," sighed Shirley. "They had a row or something. I expect she's gone home to try and patch things up."
"Never a dull moment,"
said Howard, bouncing lightly off alternate walls of the narrow hallway as he navigated his way carefully towards the bedroom. Shirley brought up her favourite medical website. When she typed in the first letter of the condition she wished to investigate, the site offered its explanation of EpiPens again, so Shirley swiftly revised their use and content, because she might yet have an opportunity to save their potboy's life. Next, she carefully typed in eczema, and learned, somewhat to her disappointment, that the condition was not infectious, and could not, therefore, be used as an excuse to sack Sukhvinder Jawanda. From sheer force of habit, she then typed in the address of the Pagford Parish Council website and clicked onto the message board. She had grown to recognise at a glance the shape and length of the username "The Ghost of Barry Fairbrother," just as a besotted lover knows at once the back of the beloved's head, or the set of their shoulders, or the tilt of their walk. A single glimpse at the topmost message sufficed. Excitement exploded. He had not forsaken her. She had known that Dr. Jawanda's outburst could not go unpunished. "Affair of the First Citizen of Pagford." She read it, but did not at first understand. She had been expecting to see Parminder's name. She read it again, and gave the suffocated gasp of a woman being hit by icy water. "Howard Mollison, First Citizen of Pagford, and long-standing resident Maureen Lowe have been more than business partners for many years. It is common knowledge that Maureen holds regular tastings of Howard's finest salami. The only person who appears not to be in on the secret is Shirley, Howard's wife." Completely motionless in her chair, Shirley thought, "It's not true. It could not be true." Yes, she had once or twice suspected, had hinted sometimes to Howard. No, she would not believe it. She could not believe it. But other people would. They would believe the ghost. Everybody believed him. Her hands were like empty gloves, fumbling and feeble, as she tried, with many a blunder, to remove the message from the site. Every second that it remained there, somebody else might be reading it, believing it, laughing about it, passing it to the local newspaper. Howard and Maureen. Howard and Maureen. The message was gone. Shirley sat and stared at the computer monitor, her thoughts scurrying like mice in a glass bowl, trying to escape, but there was no way out, no firm foothold. No way of climbing back to the happy place she had occupied before she saw that dreadful thing written in public for the world to see. He had laughed at Maureen. No, she had laughed at Maureen. Howard had laughed at Kenneth. Always together, holidays and work days and weekend excursions. Only person who appears not to be in on the secret. She and Howard did not need sex. Separate beds for years. They had a silent understanding. Holds regular tastings of Howard's finest salami. Shirley's mother was alive in the room with her, cackling and jeering, at last slopping wine. Shirley could not bear dirty laughter. She'd never been able to bear ribaldry or ridicule. She jumped up, tripping over the chair legs, and hurried back to the bedroom. Howard was still asleep, lying on his back, making rumbling, porcine noises. "Howard," she said. "Howard." It took a whole minute to rouse him.
He was confused and disorientated, but as she stood over him, she saw him still as a knight protector who could save her.
Howard, the ghost of Barry Fairbrother's put up another message.
Disgruntled at his rude awakening, Howard made a growling, groaning noise into the pillow.
About you, said Shirley.
They did very little plain speaking, she and Howard. She had always liked that. But today she was driven to it.
About you,
she repeated.
And Maureen. It says you've been...
having an affair. His big hand slid up over his face and he rubbed his eyes. He rubbed them longer, she was convinced, than he needed.
What?
He said, his face shielded.
You and Maureen having an affair.
Where does he get that from?
No denial, no outrage, no scathing laughter, merely a cautious request for a source. Ever afterwards, Shirley would remember this moment as a death, a life truly ended. 7.
Fucking shut up, Robbie, shut up!
Crystal had dragged Robbie to a bus stop several streets away so that neither Obbo nor Terry could find them. She was not sure she had enough money for the fare, but she was determined to get to Pagford. Nana Cath was gone, Mr. Fairbrother was gone, but Fats Wall was there, and she needed to make a baby.
Why was he in the room with you?
Crystal shouted at Robbie, who grizzled and did not answer. There was only a tiny amount of battery power left on Terry's mobile phone. Crystal called Fats's number, but it went to voicemail. In Church Row, Fats was busy eating toast and listening to his parents having one of their familiar, bizarre conversations in the study across the hall. It was a welcome distraction from his own thoughts. The mobile in his pocket vibrated, but he did not answer it. There was nobody he wanted to talk to. It would not be Andrew. Not after last night.
Colin, you know what you're supposed to do,
his mother was saying. She sounded exhausted.
Please, Colin. We had dinner with them on Saturday night, the night before he died. I cooked. What if, Colin, you didn't put anything in the food, for God's sake? Now I'm doing it. I'm not supposed to do this, Colin. You know I'm not supposed to get into it. This is your OCD talking. But I might have, Tess. I suddenly thought, what if I put something? Then why are we alive? You, me and Mary. They did a post-mortem, Colin. Nobody told us the details. Mary never told us. I think that's why she doesn't want to talk to me anymore. She suspects. Colin, for Christ's sake.
Tess's voice became an urgent whisper, too quiet to hear. Fats's mobile vibrated again. He pulled it out of his pocket. Crystal's number. He answered.
Hiya,
said Crystal, over what sounded like a kid shouting.
Do you want to meet up?
Dunno, yawned Fats. He had been intending to go to bed.
I'm coming into Pagford on the bus. We could hook up.
Last night he had pressed Gaia Borden into the railings outside the town hall until she had pulled away from him and thrown up. Then she had started to berate him again, so he had left her there and walked home. I don't know, he said. He felt so tired, so miserable.
Go on,
she said. From the study, he heard Colin.
You say that, but would it show up? What if I... Colin, we shouldn't be going into this. You're not supposed to take these ideas seriously. How can you say that to me? How can I not take it seriously if I'm responsible?
Yeah, all right, said Fats to Crystal. I'll meet you in 20, front of the pub in the square. 8. Samantha was driven from the spare room at last by her urgent need to pee. She drank cold water from the tap in the bathroom until she felt sick, gulped down 2 paracetamol from the cabinet over the sink, then took a shower. She dressed without looking at herself in the mirror. Through everything she did, she was alert for some noise that would indicate the whereabouts of Miles, but the house seemed to be silent. Perhaps, she thought, He had taken Lexi out somewhere, away from her drunken, lecherous, cradle-snatching mother.
"He was in Lexi's class at school,"
Miles had spat at her, once they were alone in their bedroom. She had waited for him to move away from the door, then wrenched it back open and run to the spare room. Nausea and mortification came over her in waves. She wished she could forget that she had blacked out, but she could still see the boy's face as she launched herself at him. She could remember the feel of his body pressed against her, so skinny, so young. If it had been Vikram Jawanda, there might have been some dignity in it. She had to get coffee. She could not stay in the bathroom forever. But as she turned to open the door, she saw herself in the mirror, and her courage almost failed. Her face was puffy, her eyes hooded, the lines in her face etched more deeply by pressure and dehydration. Oh, God, what must he have thought of me? Miles was sitting in the kitchen when she entered. She did not look at him, but crossed straight to the cupboard where the coffee was. Before she had touched the handle, he said, "I've got some here." "Thanks," she muttered, and poured herself out a mug, avoiding eye contact.
"I've sent Lexi over to Mum and Dad's," said Miles. "We need to talk."
Samantha sat down at the kitchen table.
"Go on, then," she said.
"Go on? Is that all you can say?"
"You're the one who wants to talk."
"Last night," said Miles, "at my father's birthday party, I came to look for you, and I found you snogging a 16-year-old,
yes," said Samantha. "Legal. One good thing."
He stared at her, appalled.
"You think this is funny? If you'd found me so drunk that I didn't even realize..."
"I did realize," said Samantha. She refused to be Shirley, to cover everything up with a frilly little tablecloth of polite fiction. She wanted to be honest, and she wanted to penetrate that thick coating of complacency through which she no longer recognized a young man she had loved.
"You did realize..." "What?" said Miles.
He had so plainly expected embarrassment and contrition that she almost laughed.
"I did realize that I was kissing him," she said.
He stared at her, and her courage seeped away because she knew what he was going to say next.
"And if Lexi had walked in?" Samantha had no answer to that. The thought of Lexi knowing what had happened made her want to run away and not come back. And what if the boy told her? They had been at school together. She had forgotten what Pagford was like.
"What the hell's going on with you?" asked Miles.
"I'm unhappy," said Samantha. "Why?" asked Miles, but then he added quickly, "Is it the shop? Is it that?"
"A bit," said Samantha. "But I hate living in Pagford. I hate living on top of your parents. And sometimes," she said slowly, "I hate waking up next to you."
She thought he might get angry, but instead he asked quite calmly,
"Are you saying you don't love me anymore?"
"I don't know," said Samantha.
He seemed thinner in his open-necked shirt. For the first time in a long while, she thought she'd glimpsed somebody familiar and vulnerable inside the aging body across the table. "And he still wants me," she thought, with wonder, recalling the crumpled face in the mirror upstairs. "But I was glad," she added, "the night that Barry Fairbrother died, that you were still alive. I think I dreamt you weren't. And I woke up, and I know I was happy when I heard you breathing."
"And that's all you got to say to me, is it? You're glad I'm not dead?"
She had been wrong to think that he was not angry. He had simply been in shock.
"That's all you've got to say to me.
You get absolutely ratted at my father's birthday.
Would it have been better if it hadn't been your bloody father's party? She shouted, his anger igniting hers. Was that the real problem? That I showed you up in front of Mummy and Daddy?
You were kissing a 16-year-old boy!
Maybe he'll be the first of many!
Yelled Samantha, getting up from the table and slamming her mug down in the sink. The handle came off in her hand.
Don't you get it, Miles! I've had enough! I hate our fucking life and I hate your fucking parents!
You don't mind them paying for the girl's education.
I hate you turning into your father in front of me.
Absolute bollocks. You just don't like me being happy when you're not.
Whereas my darling husband doesn't give a shit how I feel.
Plenty for you to do round here, but you'd rather sit at home and sulk.
I don't intend to sit at home anymore, Miles.
Not going to apologise for getting involved with the community.
Well, I meant what I said. You're not fit to fill his shoes.
What? He said, and his chair fell over as he jumped to his feet, while Samantha strode to the kitchen door.
You heard me, she shouted. Like my letter said, Miles, you're not fit to fill Barry Fairbrother's shoes. He was sincere.
Your letter, he said.
Yep,
she said breathlessly, with her hand on the doorknob.
I sent that letter. Too much to drink one evening. While you were on the phone to your mother. And,
she pulled the door open,
I didn't vote for you either.
The look on his face unnerved her. Out in the hall, she slipped on clogs, the first pair of shoes she could find, and was through the front door before he could catch up. 9. The journey took Crystal back to her childhood. She had made this trip daily to St. Thomas's, all on her own, on the bus. She knew when the Abbey would come into sight, and she pointed it out to Robbie.
See the big ruined castle?
Robbie was hungry, but slightly distracted by the excitement of being on a bus. Crystal held his hand tightly. She had promised him food when they got off at the other end. But she did not know where she would get it. Perhaps she could borrow money from Fats for a bag of crisps, not to mention the return bus fare.
I went to school here, she told Robbie,
while he wiped his fingers on the dirty windows, making abstract patterns. And you'll go to school here too. When they rehoused her, because of her pregnancy, they were almost certain to give her another Fields house. Nobody wanted to buy them, they were so run down. But Crystal saw this as a good thing, because in spite of their dilapidation, it would put Robbie and the baby in the catchment area for St. Thomas's. Anyway, Fats's parents would almost certainly give her enough money for a washing machine once she had their grandchild. They might even get a television. The bus rolled down a slope towards Pagford, and Crystal caught a glimpse of the glittering river, briefly visible before the road sank too low. She had been disappointed when she joined the rowing eight that they did not practice on the oar, but on the dirty old canal in Yarville.
Here we are,
Crystal told Robbie, as the bus turned slowly into the flower-decked square. Fats had forgotten that waiting in front of the black cannon meant standing opposite Mollison and Lowe's and the copper kettle. There was more than an hour to go until midday, when the cafes opened on Sundays, but Fats did not know how early Andrew had to arrive for work. He had no desire to see his oldest friend this morning, so he skulked down the side of the pub out of sight, and only emerged when the bus arrived. It pulled away, revealing Crystal and a small, dirty-looking boy. Nonplussed, Fats loped towards them.
"He's my brother," said Crystal, aggressively,
in response to something she had seen in Fats's face. Fats made another mental adjustment to what gritty and authentic life meant. He had been fleetingly taken with the idea of knocking Crystal up and showing Cubby what real men were able to achieve casually without effort, but this little boy clinging to his sister's hand and leg disconcerted him. Fats wished that he'd not agreed to meet her. She was making him ridiculous. He would rather have gone back to that stinking, squalid house of hers now that he saw her in the square.